Esther chapter 2. Because this is such a narrative type of book, and that is simply a story being told with amazing theology tucked into it, it can get a little dry if you're not a history buff, if you're not interested in the narration of it. And so we're going to be moving kind of quickly after the last several weeks of setup messages through with the book of Esther. And so this morning we're going to predominantly be taking the entire chapter 2, and we'll be taking a look at it this morning and see what God has for us. Would you stand with me, please, as we read Esther chapter 2, verses 1 through 17. After these things, when the anger of King Ahasuerus had abated, he remembered Vashti and what she had done and what had been decreed against her. Then the king's young men who attended him said, "Let beautiful young virgins be sought out for the king, and let the king appoint officers in all the provinces of his kingdom to gather all the beautiful young virgins to the harem in Susa, the citadel, under custody of Haggai, the king's eunuch, who is in charge of the women. Let their cosmetics be given them, and let the young women who please the king be queen. Let the young woman who pleases the king be queen instead of Vashti." This pleased the king, and he did so. Now there was a Jew in Susa the citadel whose name was Mordecai, the son of Jair, son of Shimei, son of Kish, a Benjamite, who had been carried away from Jerusalem among the captives, carried away with Jeconiah, king of Judah, when Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, had carried them away. He was bringing up Hadassah, that is Esther, the daughter of his uncle, for she had neither father nor mother. The young woman had a beautiful figure and was lovely to look at. And when her father and her mother died, Mordecai took her as his own daughter. So when the king's order and his edict were proclaimed, and when young women were gathered in Susa, the citadel, in custody of Haggai, Esther was also taken into the king's palace and put in custody of Haggai, who had charge of the women. And the young woman pleased him and won his favor. And he quickly provided her with her cosmetics and her portion of food, and with 7 chosen young women from the king's palace, and advanced her and her young women to the best place in the harem. Esther had not made known her people or kindred, for Mordecai had commanded her not to make it known. And every day Mordecai walked in front of the court of the harem to learn how Esther was and what was happening to her. Now when the turn came for each young woman to go into King Ahasuerus, after being 12 months under the regulations for the women, since this was the regular period of their beautifying, 6 months with oil of myrrh and 6 months with spices and ointments for women, when the young woman went into the king in this way, she was given whatever she desired to take with her from the harem to the king's palace. In the evening, she would go in, and in the morning, she would return to the second harem in custody of Shazgaz, the king's eunuch, who was in charge of the concubines. She would not go in to the king again, unless the king delighted in her and she was summoned by name. When the turn came for Esther, the daughter of Abihail, the uncle of Mordecai, who had taken her as his own daughter, to go into the king, she asked for nothing except what Haggai, the king's eunuch, who had charge of the women, advised. Now Esther was winning favor in the eyes of all who saw her. And when Esther was taken to King Ahasuerus into his royal palace in the 10th month, which is the month of Tebeth, in the 7th year of his reign, the king loved Esther more than all the women. And she won grace and favor in his sight more than all the virgins, so that he set the royal crown on her head and made her queen instead of Vashti. May the Lord add his blessings upon the reading of the word, and you may be seated. My intentions are to get through this message today, but let's, for sake of honesty, say this is part one. I've entitled the message today, A Compromise, A Royal Compromise. Now, sometimes in life, we think compromises are good. If you've ever sat on any committee whatsoever, church committee, public committee, whatever committee, school committee you've ever sat on, you know that compromise is needed in those committees. But there are times that compromise is not right. And you're going to see that this morning in this royal compromise. I hope what we see this morning is a warning and also a call of hope. So listen for both, because that's my problem this morning. I don't want to do part one and simply give us the warning, because I don't know if it's been impressed upon you as much as the table of communion has been impressed upon me, that was a warning to us this morning. And we don't want to just simply walk out of church each and every time just simply with warnings on our breath. But then there are times that we need to have warnings placed upon us. I was thankful for this morning's music. There wasn't anything in reveille. There wasn't any celebration-type music. This was a slowed-down, solemn-type music, and of which wasn't intended. We don't set out to do that. God in his providence does all of that. And so I believe that it's important for us to see, because there is an amazing amount of warnings in the scripture for us. God is a gracious and caring God, and he places those warnings before us. And so when we gather together, I think there's times that we need to hear those. So we're going to hear a warning this morning, but we're also going to hear this call of hope. It's a warning against capitulation of the forces of sin and forces of the flesh that are currently in our lives. I want to hear the message of Esther that regardless of any good that comes from my bad behavior, it is still bad behavior, which is sin against a holy God. So it doesn't matter the pragmatistic approach that we say, well, my bad behavior is going to result in something good. Beware, my friend. It is still sin against a holy God. And you'll see that as it unfolds this morning. I want us to see that sin has amazing, long-reaching tentacles in its grasp. And sometimes we think that it's just immediate. Sometimes it is immediate. Sometimes the actions of our sins and the results of it, the consequences, are instant. And we see them. Many times it has long tentacles. It affects not only us. It affects not only you, but it affects your loved ones. It affects friends. And I submit to you that it affects culture at large. Sinful and bad behavior can have generational effects. I don't know if we've ever thought about that. Have we ever thought that possibly my sinful behavior may be paid for to some degree by my children or my grandkids or my great-grandkids? But Scripture's pretty clear that sin has that effect and can be felt generations upon generations. And so I want us to see that. I also want us to see hope that even in our sinful behavior, that sinful behavior can be used and is being used by God to redeem history. He uses Esther's sinful behavior. He's going to use Mordecai's sinful behavior to have a redemptive plan in mind and utilizing that sinful behavior to affect his plan. I also want us to see the hope that no sin ever, ever places us beyond the reach of God's mercy. Ever. It doesn't matter how far we have fallen. It doesn't matter how morally we have failed. We are never beyond the reach of God's forgiveness. I want us to see that our sound and good decisions in our life, God is at work at. That's obvious. But I also want us to see that he is in the midst of, and I submit to you, in the working of, every time that you and I shrink back from him. Every time that you and I lack faith, and we find it very small. Every time that we deny him and his truths, God is still working. I want us to see hope in that. So oftentimes we just throw ourselves up and say, how could God love such a person? How could God love such a wretch? How could God love such a worm as I? And I want us to see hope in the midst of that, that God is in the midst of working that for a purpose of which his purposes will stand. I want us to leave here either today or even next week with a warning on our hearts to consider the coziness that we have with the world. I want us to be concerned about that. I want us to contemplate the coziness that we find with a culture which has gone absolutely mad. I want us to leave with a warning on our hearts about our discernment or our lack thereof of the choices that we make in life. Are they godly choices or are they worldly choices? I want others to leave with a renewed hope. I want us to leave, many of us, with renewed hope that we are never, ever beyond God's forgiveness, no matter how far we fell or how badly we have failed. The story of Esther is a story of rags to riches to some degree. You've seen in the setup messages a lot of what I'm going to say here this morning, but it's sort of a rags to riches story, and we all like them, don't we? You watch any part of the Disney shows or the Hallmark shows, there's always those types of shows going on, and they just put a little bit of a smile on your face. It's those rags to riches story. It's the story of the local girl making it big in the Olympics in Rio. And she has all the endorsements she could ever want, and she lives happily ever after, financially. Everything you're taken care of. It's the story of the little English girl selling on the corner her flowers for a dollar. You know, the story from all those shows that you watch. I'm thinking a few of them, and I'm not going to sing any of the songs or whatever, but you know the ones where she's selling the very poor, and she just can only sell for a tuppence, ma'am, a tuppence, you know, a flower. Here, sir, give your lovely wife this flower for a tuppence. And you know the story. And the rags to riches is that she catches the eye of the handsome aristocrat, and he eventually falls in love with her. They marry, and she comes back, and she buys the orphanage and makes all things well for all the kids in the orphanage. You know the rags to riches story that we talk about. And to some degree, that's Esther. To some degree, we're going to see that. But you're also going to see her cost to rise to wealth and power. You're going to see the cost to Esther. I hope many of us begin to ask ourselves, is it worth it? It's so much more than simply catching the eye of a good-looking prince. It's simply much more than dancing in the ballroom, the one dance with the prince. Because you're going to see Esther, she's going to do so much more than simply dance for her prince. I want us to begin in chapter 2 and just in verse 1, and I want to set the stage with the times. After these things, when the anger of King Ahasuerus had abated, he remembered Vashti and what she had done and what had been decreed against her. Now, the grammar is pretty interesting here. When you look at this particular word, after these things, when the anger of the king had abated, he remembered Vashti. Most scholars, most of the stuff that I was able to read over the last several weeks, the grammar, how it's put together here, leads us to believe that there's some time has passed since what has occurred to Vashti, and you know that from last week. And he is beginning to remember. The actual interpretation of this word remember in Hebrew means with robust recollection. He is remembering. With robust recollection, he begins to remember Vashti. He's contemplating his vanquished queen. And so it allows us to speculate a little bit, just based upon the grammar and the timing here. What was he remembering of Vashti? Remember, she's beautiful. Remember what drives the empire. Remember what floats his boat, if you will. It is beauty. It is physical beauty. And so is he fondly remembering her? Is he warmly reminiscing about her beauty and wondering, did I make the right decision? Oh, I know she back-talked me. I know she defied the empire of Persia. I know all that. But did I do the right thing in vanquishing her? Was my edict too strong? And so out of some concern, he has some advisors come up to him, and they're going to try to assess this situation. They're going to try to give some semblance and some patronizing to the king at this particular point. Because if you remember, it's probably the same advisors who came to him and says, you know what you need to do back in chapter 1? You need to look for someone better than Vashti. That was the purpose of what they did. You boot her out, tell her she can't come into your presence again. You take the crown away from her, and you boot her out because you can find someone better than Vashti. And so their solution is simple. We are going to send out an edict from the king And there's going to be a hunt for all the women in this kingdom for the perfect queen for King Ahasuerus. Now, there's a real short criterion given here in the scriptures. They have to be young, they have to be beautiful, and they have to be a virgin. Young, beautiful, virgin. That's all the criteria that they have set out for. And so the hunt begins. For the rest of their lives, there are going to be many, many, many women's lives changed because the hunt begins for this competition. But it isn't a simple competition. It is not a competition where you can simply make an application to with Donald Trump and Miss America or whatever one he handles, whichever, I don't know if he still does anymore. You make an application, you go through all the different process, and you end up on a stage somewhere someday. It's not that type of competition, if you will. They will come, whether voluntarily or whether by force, they will come to the royal harem. Keep in mind, there's only going to be one chosen, just one for the queen. But none of these females are ever going to leave. You can always check in, but you can never check out from the Hotel California, okay? I didn't really say that, but you understand what I'm saying. You can check in, but you're never going to check out. That is the picture of these females coming to the palace. The losers, those which weren't chosen, would be placed in the royal harem at the king's beck and call. The king had a collection. He had a collection of women. They are his toys, if you will. He will keep them in perfect splendor, but he will keep them in seclusion. Everything that they could possibly ever want in this world is going to be provided for them. But they are part of his collection, and he's going to take care of it. No one's going home. The empire didn't care if you had any future plans. Oh, I'm going to marry my Prince Charming someday. I'm going to live in a little hillside out here. We're going to have a couple of goats and a couple of chickens and we're going to have 2.5 kids. And you know that whole story, right? It doesn't matter what your plans are. It doesn't matter what your parents' plans were for you. There's nothing sexist about it either. It's not just the women that the empire controlled. The men could instantly be taken as eunuchs for the empire. They could be taken into their soldiery. They could be taken in as an army. They could be taken in anything whatsoever that you considered, including your body, was a possession of the empire. But it's interesting. Because of the culture at this particular time, very few people would resist the summons to respond. Very few. They would line up. They would simply say, I'm going to be taken care of. It's an honor, isn't it, to be placed into the king's harem. What a wonderful opportunity this is. I will have a comfortable life, Mom and Dad. Don't worry about me. Everything that I could possibly want is going to be given to me. It is like winning the lottery. Wait till we get to the $100 million lottery being given away again and begin to watch the people lining up to buy their lottery tickets. For what purpose? Because of that dream, that sense that I won't have to worry about anything else ever again. All of my desires will be brought forth. Seems a little far-fetched that people would line up for it, but as I began to think about it, in our own culture, it isn't that very far-fetched. How many people do we know that their very existence, their entire effort in life is about their working career? So for what reason? So that we can simply have whatever we want. We can have ease in our retirement. We can have ease even prior to retirement. I want a comfortable salary. I want security in that. And that is what pushes us on. That is what constantly pushes us on. And sometimes if we allow that push to get so ingrained into us that it pushes us beyond even the deepest held convictions that you and I might have of right and wrong. That's a picture of what you're going to see Esther and Mordecai and how it unfolds. Well, the world complexion, the empire's complexion has changed of its demands. Okay, we're not going to demand that our kids be placed into harems and made eunuchs in the White House. But still, culture itself still has a picture of success and ease that we constantly push ourselves into. It is what we find ourselves being driven to. It's not that different today than it was in Esther's time. So let's meet Esther. In verses 5 through 7, now there was a Jew in Susa, the citadel, whose name was Mordecai, the son of Jairus, son of Shimei, son of Kish, a Benjamite, who had been carried away from Jerusalem, among the captives, carried away with Jeconiah, the king of Judah, whom Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, had carried away. He was bringing up Hadassah. That is Esther, the daughter of his uncle, for she had neither a father nor a mother. The young woman had a beautiful figure and was lovely to look at. And when her father and her mother died, Mordecai took her as his own daughter. A Jewish girl. And we know that. And you're going to see this identity problem in Esther. You're going to see this identity conflict in her. She's a Jewish girl. She's living right under the nose of King Ahasuerus. She's in the citadel. She's in the capital city of Susa itself. So she's right next door to him. She doesn't have a living father. She doesn't have a living mother. She's being raised by her cousin Mordecai, who treats her like her own daughter. Now, the writer here treats the lineage and the genealogies of Mordecai and Esther extensively for a reason. Especially, I'm telling you, this you're going to have to wait several months for. But get to chapter 10, and you're going to see how this plays out. That Mordecai is a descendant of Kish. He's of the tribe of Benjamin. And therefore, that makes him related to King Saul. And you're going to see the orders that were given to King Saul years and years and years ago to be followed out. You're going to see how that's going to play out. So it's so important here at the very beginning for us to understand the lineage and the ancestry of Mordecai and of Esther. But Mordecai's ancestors were carried off in exile at least 3 or 4 generations prior. They have been carried off into exile. 100 years has passed since the downthrow and the final judgment upon this nation of Israel, and they have been completely placed into this bondage of the Persian Empire. So we know that Mordecai and Esther know no other existence whatsoever other than exile. That's all they know. They didn't know times of freedoms. They wouldn't have experienced what their forefathers were able to speak about. They have known nothing but of exile, and it defines their very existence. And you're going to find that conflict begin to grow right off the bat. The conflict, I believe, in the cultures between the Jews and Persia is evident right off the bat. Mordecai is defined as a Jew, kosher genealogy, all the way back to the great days of Israel. He hasn't really known the destruction of his homeland because that was generations before. But yet, because he is called a Jew, Mordecai has not yet totally assimilated. And if you remember my couple of messages back of how it'd be assimilated into it, Mordecai has not yet completely assimilated into the Persian culture because he's known by his Hebrew name, Mordecai. Here, he's even referred to as a Jew. But on the other hand, he is known by his Hebrewized Persian name, Mordecai, which comes from the god Marduk. He is named after one of the gods of Persia, Marduk. That is how he is identified here, as a Jew, but yet with a Hebrewized name from Marduk, one of the very gods. Doesn't mean that he worshiped this pagan god. But it does begin to show you that he is quite ambivalent. He is quite non-caring whether he's known as a Jew or whether he's a Persian Empire follower. It doesn't really matter to him. He's a citizen of Persia, and he's also a Jew at the same time. There's a sense, and you're going to see that unfold, but it begins right here, that at home, Mordecai is the Jew, the faithful follower of Jehovah of the Old Testament. But probably in the workplace, he's Mordecai, follower of the empire. That's how he's known. And so right off the bat, we begin to see this conflict, and you'll see it progress over the next several weeks as we look even closer to it. But we begin to see this right here. Also, Esther herself is introduced to us by two names. First, her Hebrew name, Hadassah, which means myrtle, which once again shows a very kosher, very Jewish heritage. However, the empire knew her by her Persian name, which is Esther, short for star, which is an allusion to their goddess Ishtar. And so you see that she had become quite assimilated to some degree into the Persian lifestyle, even so that she was known, not by Hadassah, but she was known by Esther. The book is named. It's interesting, isn't it? You think, oh yeah, the books are Hadassah, Job, Psalms. What? No, it's Esther, Job, and Psalms. We know her by her Persian name. And so once again, we get the sense right off the bat here that she has once again found herself living amongst the people of which she absolutely has no problem whatsoever in choosing between those two worlds, being known as Esther. And you're going to see that choice that she's going to make. You're going to see her choice that she's going to be making, whether or not to align herself with the world and its culture, or whether to align herself with God and his people. And you're going to see the effects of it. You're going to see the effects upon an entire people because of decisions that she's going to make. Now, Esther quickly learns how to survive. But I submit to you, she even knows more than that. She knows how to thrive. Look at verse 9. And the young woman pleased him and won his favor. The young woman pleased him and won his favor. Talking about the eunuch that's in charge of all of the women here, the Haggai. That she won his favor. Esther learned very quickly that life in this harem isn't anything more than simply a microcosm of what goes on in the rest of the empire. She knew very well that it is pointless. It is a pointless existence. All of my life just on the outside was regulated by the government regulations and by the minutiae. I mean, the edict of the king saying that a woman can't even question her husband, that whole garbage of him trying to be a controller of everything in the minutest details. It's the same thing here. And she also knew that if she had any intentions of getting ahead, it depended upon who you knew. It wasn't a matter of your character. It wasn't a matter of your integrity in this empire. It was a matter of who you knew and what you did for them. There was a quid pro quo mentality going on. You scratch my back, I'll scratch your back. And she knew that. And she found herself being bounced right into the very middle of this. Esther learned right off the bat she needed to please the keeper of the harem, Haggai. You know that by the way that the idiom that is used in the Hebrew here, that he won his favor. It's an active part on her. That isn't somebody, just because of who she is, just sitting around the wallflower that you just happen to notice and you see, well, there's some real good qualities in her. No, it's a very clearly, this idiom is saying that she won his favor. It's an active idiom. It's an active part on hers, that she is going out intentionally winning the favor of Haggai here. Now, she's doubly blessed, though. Look what the scriptures say. She has a beautiful figure and she's lovely to look at. She has both things going for her. It wasn't just one or the other. She's got the package deal. And so she's doubly blessed from this particular perspective. She knows that the Persian Empire, and the king in particular, is driven by physical beauty. The entire, it's all about the outward in the Persian Empire. It's all about what you have. It's all about how you can impress people. It's all about how you look. So Esther has to go beyond her physical beauty. Because it's interesting, isn't it? Why were the other 1,000 women or so that have been picked? Why were they picked? For the same reasons. So she's not sitting there with ugly ducklings all around her. She's sitting there in the midst of some very beautiful women. And so she knows that she has to go beyond that. And she has to win the favor of Haggai. She works at her promotion by simply fitting into the program. She accepts the agenda set by culture. She accepts the stupidity, as we saw last week, in the whole idea of satire that's being used in the scripture. She accepted all of that and said, you know, if that's the way I've got to make a headway in this empire, that's exactly what I'm going to do. I'm willing to let the empire to define my identity and her worth. Have you begun to think about this? And I hope you're starting to draw some very clear parallels with our culture. She's allowing the empire to define her worth. She's allowing the empire to define who she is. She finds it very easily. She wants to be assimilated. Resistance to her isn't even on her radar at this particular time. She will become whatever culture demands of her. In return for this, special treatment. Look at the next verse, verse 9. Special food and early and extensive treatment, beauty treatments. And he quickly provided her with her cosmetics and her portion of food, and with 7 chosen young women from the king's palace, and advanced her and her young women to the best place in the harem. It's interesting. I didn't want to spend too much time, and I don't know where to cut this message off this morning. But it's interesting of the importance that we see, the importance that the culture was placing upon beauty and the physical attraction of women during this particular time. Does that sound familiar? Okay? It's what was going on here. It was, if you were going to be beautiful and you were going to be in the king's harem, you had a 12-month treatment program, beauty treatment. You already were pretty. You already have a lot going for you, but it ain't good enough for the king. And so 6 months of oil, of myrrh, and 6 months of spices and ointments. It's believed by many of the commentators that they literally spent their time in these ointments, or were fumigated in rooms with these ointments and these spices for that time to create beauty. Okay? She smells really good. You know what I mean, Bubba? She really smells good. These women smelled this way for eons afterward because they've spent a year being fumigated or being actually dunked into these chemical baths, if you will, and special food. Now, it's interesting here, too. If you begin to look back at this particular time, food was probably given to them to fatten them up a little bit. Okay, we have this idea in our culture that it's all about being skinny. It's all about losing weight. Ooh, I see you lost weight. Looking good. Oh, see, you put on 16 pounds. You're looking real good there, buddy. Okay, we don't do that today, but that was Persian time. That was their time that it was probably given extra food to put a little, as they say, meat on the bones. That's a picture of what we have going on here. And she knew it. Esther knew whatever the king wanted, whether it was skinny or whether it was some weight, she knew specifically what he wanted. And she was willing to play that game and to win the favor of the eunuch that was in charge so that she got her special treatment completely apart from most of the other women, other than the 7 that she was with at this particular time. Keep in mind, you're going to see this probably next week. There's well over 1,000 women in the harem at this particular time. Well over 1,000. And Esther's not on the top of the list to go in. She's probably going to be way down the list. And so she knows that she needs all the advantage she can get. And she takes all the advantage of what she's been given here. Sounds familiar though, doesn't it? In our culture today. Our girls are told they need the Barbie doll figure. I mean, have you thought about that? Even at the youngest of ages, we give them those little Barbie dolls which have that perfect figure with them. And they right off the bat realize that's what I'm looking for. They also know they have to have blemish-free skin. They have to have that perfect baby's behind complexion without the little dimples, you know, that the baby behind gets. But it's got to have that complexion look to it. That's exactly what our culture says. Our young girls are constantly bombarded from everything they pick up, from their social media to magazines to TV to whatever it is, the images and the pressures to look a certain way and to act a certain way and to smell a certain way.
to dress, to walk, to assimilate to the empire. That's what's going on. It's exactly what's going on. So we think this is different. It's no different than what it is today. Our young ladies are being told they need to assimilate to the empire. If you're going to be worth anything, you're going to look like this. If you're going to be worth anything, you're going to be this. And let me show you what you may have to do to get that. Is it any wonder why our girls struggle with this at every turn? They're being told completely, this is what it is. This is what success is. Completely pictured in the world of the empire. And unfortunately, many of them begin to understand that. To understand that if I'm going to attract one of the boys of the empire, I'm probably going to have to assimilate. I'm probably going to have to act in a particular way. It's no different. It's no different than what Esther was going through at this particular time. This is a freebie, dads. I'm probably going to close with it. But this is a freebie for our fathers. We need to impress upon our daughters their beauty and their worth as fathers. We need to sit them down on a regular basis and impress upon them their beauty to us. We need to impress upon them their worth is not from their social media. Their worth is not from what they look like. But their worth is found in a person named Jesus Christ who died for them upon a cross and gave them all the worth in the world, making them a child of the Heavenly Father. That's where their worth comes from. That's what we as fathers need to impress upon our kids, our young ladies. We give them that worth. We need them to understand that they are made in the very image of the Creator. And if they're made in the image of the Creator, they have beauty. That's where it comes from. Not from eating the king's food and having the king's cosmetics given to them. But their worth and their beauty comes from that. And I want to tell you something else you can do. You can tell your daughters they're worthy because they're your daughter. Have you ever thought about that? What it might mean to your daughter to hear, you're worth more than anything to me because you're my daughter. And when they begin to understand that, then we simply transform. You're my daughter, but you are also the daughter of the Most High. Don't anybody ever let that take from you. Dads, that's what we need to be doing with our kids, with our daughters. We need to be on a regular basis showing them that their beauty, their worth, doesn't come from the empire, but comes from their being made in the image of God and a Savior who died for them and is loved by an earthly father. That's it in a nutshell for us on how to raise daughters. They're difficult. Oh, where's Hannah? Okay, sorry. Daughters are hard. Give me four boys. Daughters are difficult. But folks, the answer is that we let them find their value. We let them define themselves as to who they truly are. What is their identity? Is their identity going to be defined by the empire? Or is their identity going to be defined by this as exemplified by godly fathers in their lives? I'm not leaving moms off the hook. I'm just talking to dads this morning, though. Because I'm just passionate about that particular area. It's a shame that Esther is going to hide her identity. Verse 10 is going to tell us that, and I'm going to close. Esther had not made known her people or her kindred, for Mordecai had commanded her not to make it known. Esther was willing to compromise. You're going to see that play out next week. She was willing to compromise her true identity. Do not let our young ladies compromise their true identity by buying in to the entire empire's garbage, folks. Don't let that occur. You may not have daughters. You may be old enough to have raised daughters. But we have a congregation here that can encourage our young ladies of this church to find their true beauty and their true identity in the person and finished work of Jesus Christ, of which we have a responsibility to. Esther decided to keep her identity as a Jewish person secret because of stupid, bad advice from her cousin, her step-in father at this particular point, Mordecai. Don't hide our identity. Don't hide it. Encourage it in one another. You're going to see the ramifications of that next week. You think Esther has slipped? You think she doesn't have too much deeper to fall morally? Oh. Next week's message, I'm going to guarantee you, will still be rated G. But it could be rated much worse. I'm just going to let it go at that. You can read it. You can make your own assumptions from what is here. But folks, my encouragement to us there this morning is this. There was a royal compromise going on here. There's a royal compromise going on with Esther. Don't let that occur in our lives. Don't let that be said of us, that we compromise to the point where that's what we're known for. Because God can still use it. You're going to see hope. You're going to see amazing hope by the end of this message to know that even if we have compromised, even if we have failed, even if we have fell morally, God still is willing to stand there and say that if you will return to me, you return to me, I will lift you up. The encouragement will be there. And so be encouraged for next week's message, part two of a part three message on this royal compromise. Have a word of prayer, and we'll be dismissed with a song.